live.
Live!
From the Twin Cities with the Bob Sansevier Show. Great guests, interviews, and over 30 years of sports insight.
I'm pretty good at my job.
Here's the host of the show, Bob Sansevier.
A drive to the gap, and it will run to the gap and through the gap, and it will clear the bases. Maurer rounding second with a triple, and he will be held there. And Maurer with a big hit and almost had a chance for an inside the park home run.
What a huge hit. Boy, did the Twins need something like that.
Infield in now for Plouffe, and he drives one to right center field. That'll be chased by Martinez. He won't get that one. How many bases will Plouffe have? He wants a triple, rounding second, on his way to third on back-to-back pitches. The Twins get a pair of triples.
Fox Sports North, Dick Bremmer. You know, maybe I should go with my 6 Elvis voice.
That might work.
I think that'll work.
2 hours? No problem.
No problem.
Can you keep it up?
A little bit of cool. You know what? Maybe I should. What we should do is get Pharrell on the line.
Hey, I'm here sitting in.
On the bench.
On the bench. Pour me a big one.
Actually, it clears it up a little bit. It gets the old heart rate and phlegm. You know what? Let's have Will. I want you to call Stephen Hawking and get that little thing that he has that he types into. And we'll use, what would that be? What's it called? It's a voice
modulator
to text.
Of some.
Except he doesn't really do voice. He just types it in.
Yeah.
I'd have to go with
this. Is probably a little bit more high tech than
the one we have.
Yeah.
It probably is. This happens like once a year. But I don't sound all phlegmy, right?
I don't think so.
Do I? If I go over to the 6 Elvis voice, I don't think I do.
Yeah, people want to hear Elvis talk sports.
They like to hear Elvis talk sports?
Yeah.
Elvis was a big sports fan. You knew that, right? He used to play a lot of, they played a lot of touch football back in the day. He was always the quarterback.
Just touch football?
Just touch football. Yeah, played with the boys. Played with his guys, Red, and the crew. Actually, it was a big deal. I'm not kidding. They were big into that. And there's a somewhat local connection to Elvis. The Mike Lynn, general manager of the Vikings. He used to run a movie theater in Memphis before he got involved in football. He used to open up the theater in the middle of the night for Elvis and his crowd, his guys, the boys, to go watch movies. How about that?
That sounds fun.
Actually, imagine it would be fun to have Elvis there. You know, when I talk like that, I feel like having myself a nana and bacon sandwich. Was that what it was? Big nana bacon? Bananas and bacon?
Nana bacon. That sounds about right.
And what else did he have? It was all grease fried, too.
Well.
I tell you what, it'd be great going down, but I got a feeling it'd be the same problem. You get all bound up.
Don't they deep fry everything down the south? Just
everything's deep fried.
Even fantastic.
The ice cream is deep fried. Well, that's probably why at the fair they've had the deep fried ice cream.
What am I doing up here if everything's deep fried down there? Of course, I'd probably be dead by now if I was still down
you
there.
You wouldn't be the, what are you, 160 if that?
Yeah.
With a wind, you'd be about 560. You know, we'd have to go get the crane to take you out of bed every day.
Be a little more round.
Yeah. We'd have to roll you over to clean you. Well, I don't even think about that. There's...
Nobody does.
No, nobody wants to think about that. You know, this Deflategate is not going away. The Patriots now, their attorney is weighing in, ripping to shreds everything that's been said. You know, Wells responded, Ted Wells, the guy who did the Wells report. Well, now they're coming back and saying that the conclusions are at best incomplete, incorrect, and lack context. You know how much Wells, when he was interviewed, said that the billable hours for his company or his firm was in the millions, right? You know that the Patriots are in the they're the only ones who make any money off of this.
Mm-hmm.
Or the attorneys. They're on a bench. I got to clear my throat a little bit. That'll do it. Pour me a cold one. Isn't that what he says? Actually,
people get cold ones a lot. Something like that, but then they actually pour it.
When I do that,
I either sound like Pharrell or one of the sisters on The Simpsons. Do you ever watch The Simpsons?
Yeah.
What's that one's name?
Marge's sisters, Patty and Selma.
I sound like Patty or Selma. They all sound that way, don't they?
Yeah, pretty much. It's pretty entertaining.
Both of them sound just like that. Patty and Selma love sports.
Where's the cackler?
He's enjoying this.
Yeah. Hey, you know what? He said he would do it. Cackler, call in. We want to talk to Tom Schreier from Tom Schreier and Friends on Sunday mornings. I was hoping Sam Ekstrom would be here to ask him what he thinks about the show. Tom Schreier, he's the Friends. in the Tom Schreier and Friends show.
It's a real Abbott and Costello vibe they've got going, apparently.
Well, I know Sam's the straight man, then.
Yep, he's Bud. And then Tom gets to jump in and do all that fun stuff.
You know, actually, what would be a lot of... You know, Ruth Lorden joins us on Fridays for a segment. She channeled Vince Lombardi and Jim Thorpe and look, all these, I mean, Roselle, Pete Roselle, Carl Pollad, and basically they, you know, they sort of talk through her. What I would love is to find another psychic who channels. We get Ruth to channel Lou Costello and the other one to channel Bud Abbott, and they do the Who's on First bit together. Because if they're truly channeling, both of them would remember the bit.
Yeah.
It's the greatest baseball bit in history.
It's pretty long, too.
Third base.
When you write it out.
It's incredibly long.
I wrote it out before. It was terrible.
Why?
Back in ninth grade, I used to do that skit for people for fun because I could remember a lot of it. And then one of my buddies in a yearbook wanted me to put the whole thing in there.
The whole thing?
Yeah. So I was like, well, hand it over.
Right, give me some of the lines from it. You did both parts.
Yeah.
Okay, let me hear your Lou Costello.
Well, I didn't do impersonations of him. I just... went back and forth. Just did that whole thing.
Okay, I try to do it in
the... What's the guy's name on first base? No, what's on second?
I'm not asking you who's on first. Third base. No, it's a great bit.
Yeah.
I actually had the poster of it, and the thing that's frustrating about the poster is whoever laid it out, they transposed some of the lines. So it's you're reading along, and all of a sudden, this line should have been like six lines below that. It just ruined the whole thing. How could you be that stupid and not lay it out right?
You gotta get it right.
It is one of the greatest bits of all time. As a matter of fact, during one of the breaks, see if you can find it. We'll just play some of it. It shouldn't be that hard to find, right?
I wouldn't think so.
Well, Abbott and Costello, who's on first? I could probably find it right now if you took a look.
It's pretty far away.
Just take a look. The other thing I wanted to mention, the NFL owners are going to consider, they're going to consider three proposals at the May meetings, and that actually starts next week. They'll be given three proposals about the PAT, the extra point. They need 24 of the 32 owners.
And it becomes the rule
to
now
vote to pass. The three proposals are this. Those lying, cheating Patriots have submitted a proposal that would call for the ball to be snapped from the 15-yard line if a team decides to go for one and kicks the extra point. And it makes it about a 33-yard attempt. They did that in the preseason. Now, if you want to go for two, the ball snapped from the two. Eagles put in a proposal that the extra point would be attempted from the 15, except the big difference is the Eagles said the defense could score if they were to block it. They'd only get a point, but still. And then if you went for two, the defense could return the fumble or interception for two. And they would also, any team going for two would snap the ball from the one-yard line and not the two, which is a Patriots plan. The third plan is probably why Chip Kelly wanted Tim Tebow. For all those extra point attempts, you know, because he could run the ball with those from the two. The other one was the competition committee. They want the offense goes for two, the ball would be snapped from the two. It's really not that much different. They're all pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's all, everything moves the ball back to the 15. I don't think it's that big a deal. Leave it alone.
Yeah.
Why keep messing with this thing?
It makes no sense. They're just trying to make the game more exciting. Does it really have to be more exciting than it already is? There's already a lot going on.
It's a freaking extra point.
Yeah.
Let it go.
It's like adding, why don't they start making 60-yard field goals worth 6 points then? Really start tweaking the game.
I'd like that, especially in fantasy. Some leagues don't do that. It's usually over 50, but some of them don't do that. No, I think they got to do something about leaving the game alone once in a while instead of thinking everything has to change.
Yeah, I think they're trying to pretty much phase out kicking and punting, so there's two more roster spots so you can add, I don't know, so another person on defense, another person on offense. Let's just start cramming the field full of guys trying to score touchdowns.
Then expand the rosters so that doesn't become an issue. We're going to have Glenn Caruso. He's a football coach at St. Thomas. I want to ask him if, like, let's say the NFL did this, would it trickle down to colleges and high schools? I think the way they do it is just fine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think back now. This happened decades ago if you kicked an extra point or a field goal, it was the field goal, it was right on the goal line.
Mm-hmm.
These guys about to run around the standards. I'm trying to remember if it was that like that for high school and college too. It had to be. They must have moved it back.
Yeah, I don't know why it would have been different.
So, but that's what I'm getting at, that if they did it for high schools and colleges then, they'd probably follow suit.
Mm-hmm.
I like the two-point conversion. You know what? Too many teams don't try the conversion, the two. They want the automatic one, which is what they're trying to do away with, but force the teams to, you know, maybe give them a little more incentive. Put the ball to one instead of the, right now it's put it to two, right? Or is it to three? Yeah.
Set to two.
Put it at the one. There'd be more teams going for the two. Would you think?
Yeah. You'd still see probably a majority of the time they'd still go for the extra one, but they'd be more inclined to give it another shot or think about going for two.
If it's just from the 1 yard line? Got to be honest with you. If you're an NFL team and you don't think you can get the 1 yard, something wrong there, especially if they're Vikings. You got Adrian Peterson. Or if you're the Cowboys with that offensive line.
Wasn't Seattle about that far away not too long ago?
Yeah, but
couldn't get it in.
But they didn't run. They should have run the ball. Know what I mean?
Yep.
Who's it sound more like? Does it sound more like, is it Pharrell or the two Simpson sisters?
Sisters.
It's the sisters.
Yeah, you sound more female.
Well, you know, I do have a feminine side. It's coming out right now. Just like the sisters. No, it's, what do I need for more Pharrell? Pour another one? Pharrell on the bench!
That wasn't bad.
Pharrell on the bench!
Scotty on the bench!
Scotty. All I know is pour another one. Is that how he says it? He's actually...
The callers oftentimes, they call in and...
Yeah, they ask for one.
They ask for a cold one of some sort.
Actually, I mean, if you listen to him on 105 The Ticket, he's our... he takes us, what, to midnight?
I think he might go until 1 a.m.
He's really pretty good.
Yeah, he's a very entertaining guy.
There's times, though, when I listen to him, where I hear a real voice in there somewhere, and I wonder... no one could put that voice on all the time. That's got to be his, right?
Yeah. I mean, you'd think if that wasn't his actual voice, that it would become that way anyway, because he scratches.
Because he does it. Yeah, he scratches
the hell out of himself.
Well, we're going to talk to, like I said, Glenn Caruso. Listen to Glenn's voice, because maybe this is what it would be if he was a banker. But it sounds like it's got that constant hoarseness from yelling at players, like a lot of football coaches do.
Yeah.
You know who doesn't have that, though? Zimmer doesn't. Zimmer's actually got kind of a reedy, more high-pitched voice, except when he's yelling. Then it's a whole other world.
And he uses some different words that you don't typically hear him
shout out. Very true. He doesn't go with the Elvis voice. The best one was, you know, Jerry Burns. Hearing him yell was actually kind of funny. But his, you know, he could yell a blue streak. I mean, the expletives would come flying, but his kids swear that when he was home, he never cursed. You know, because he never used foul language around his children. He must have saved it for other times, like around the media, because he could really let the thing fly. You know what, we're going to take a quick break, and when we return, we'll talk to St. Thomas coach Glenn Caruso. Got a lot to talk to Glenn about. He's got things going on, but I want to ask him about some of these things, like the PAT changes. And is there a penalty? I mean, what's the ball have to be inflated to in college football?
12.
Is it? I don't know.
I don't know. It's probably 13, 13 and a half, somewhere there.
Well, I'll tell you what. We're going to find out when we get back. Back. And we are joined by Glenn Caruso, St. Thomas football coach. Glenn, how are you? You probably, now, I was wondering, if you were a banker, would you have your voice, or would it be different?
You know what? I think I'd have my voice no matter what, but I don't want to catch what you got, because it sounds rough.
Well, you know what, though? I feel great. That's the thing that's so frustrating about this. No, it really is. I feel fine.
Well, that's strange, but now I think no matter what we do, we probably have a similar voice. How are things going with you?
Not too bad. It's going pretty good. You've been busy. You've got your recruiting.
Yep.
You've got your spring game on Saturday, and that's got to be fun for you, right?
It is. So, you know, here recruiting, a lot of recruiting follows like the scholarship schools, because some of the kids that you look at here will also look at the Division II and Division I AA schools. So some of it is done early February, but it also bleeds into April a little bit. So, you know, since we've talked last time, the class has been finalized, and that was great. And then, as you alluded to, we have our spring game this Saturday at 1 o'clock. on our campus, inter-squad scrimmage, you know, offense versus defense, purple-white, purple-gray game, however you call it. And that's just, for a Division III program, that is wildly exciting.
Now, Glenn, can you, like D1 schools, any kids come in earlier, they can't do that at D3?
No, I mean, we can have kids. I guess technically you could have a kid. We don't. You could have a kid who graduates, you know, high school in 3.5 years and enrolls in school. I think that's a bit of the tail wagging the dog. I don't understand that at any level, but that could technically happen just like any other student. It doesn't. We're pretty fortunate, though. We did get 3 guys that transferred in back to St. Thomas at semester. And those 3 guys have been in our program now for a semester and kind of getting a jump on it. So and for that, it's a big deal.
What division do they transfer from?
There were 3 kids that transferred to us this year. Jordan Roberts, running back from FCS school, University of South Dakota, where I had coached years before.
Oh.
Yeah, really good player. He's actually from Wyoming originally, state player of the year and Gatorade player of the year in the state of Wyoming, and won a couple of state championships, and then played, started for the Bison a little, for the Coyotes a little bit. And, you know, realized that his faith was a big part of what he wanted to do and wants to work on his studies and becoming a seminarian. So he ended up transferring in a semester. We had a guard, Nick G., who transferred in from Mount Union, and then offensive athlete, Zach D'Amico, who transferred in from Butler.
Well, that's kind of neat getting a Mount Union kid.
Yeah, it's interesting just to hear the kind of how, you know, how the programs run, and you know their head coach Larry Karras. I mean, he's the standard, right? He's at one point in his career a couple years ago, his record over 8 years was like 99-1. He's got, you know, 10 national championships and all this. So we've had an opportunity of learning and listening from Larry over the years. But I noticed that the open line of communication became closed real quick back in 2012 when we started playing against them. So it's good to hear some of the stuff that goes on in their program out there.
Talking to Glenn Caruso, the St. Thomas coach. Now, Glenn, what is recruiting at D3? I mean, you can't offer them money. What can you really – is it, hey, we're going to Italy this year? Is that the part of the recruiting pitch?
Well, I mean, it hasn't been for years, but certainly I think every component of a program is open for critique and for evaluation when kids look into your school. I really believe that. And certainly in this case, the idea that we do utilize the foreign tours, that, you know, you will have an opportunity. Most of our guys, Bob, will actually study abroad, whether it's over J-term or a spring semester. And
oh,
that's
right.
Great. But for the guys that don't, this is kind of their opportunity. So, and we had touched on it before, you know, Fritz Waldvogel was a fantastic football player for us from the academy.
Yes, he
got done here. He went to Germany, had a great career over in Germany. And while he was over there playing and having fun, it was kind of a playing for pizza, you know, that Grisham novel. He was able to see 8 different countries. So that adds to the experience. But, you know, there's a lot of things. Certainly led with education, I think location. I think there's a lot of positives and negatives about every place, but it's very difficult to rationally say that this location that we have at St. Thomas does not set a kid up well for the next 40 years. You really have to go out of your way to try and say that it's not a good location for a kid when it comes to the job opportunities and the internships and all those things go into recruiting a kid.
Well, and Glenn, I've told you this, that if your campus, I thought, would be more rural, my God, you'd be one of the most popular schools in the country. Now, a lot of people like the setting in a, you know, you're in a neighborhood in St. Paul and it's neat, but you have a beautiful campus and it's just sort of like an island there in that neighborhood.
It's strange. I remember when I first drove by this campus, I was up at coaching at North Dakota State, and I drove by for recruiting, and it popped up like some sort of, premonition in the middle of the desert. I mean, it was unbelievable that in this neighborhood, this campus is here. And that's before all of the building, the recent building went on in the last 8 years. But it's amazing. You really do. And of course, I'm saying this, you know, wearing a St. Thomas logo, I get it, but you really do have the best of all worlds. You have that true campus feel with the quad and everything closed in and nice buildings. And then you have access to 2 of the country's greatest cities, you know, within 10 minutes of each other.
No, it is a great location. But again, I'm not big on driving around looking for a place to park.
Well, that's why you walk, right? So you don't have to drive around because everything's right here. So you can just walk. It kind of hits that nice balance between a small 2,000-person school, and it's not quite like the U. So it fits that.
Well, Glenn, I'm not big on walking anymore either.
You know what? Maybe I can get you one of those little strollers
that
the kids scoot on when they blow out their Achilles.
The thing you get in Walmart where you go scooting around on that.
The Rascal?
The Rascal.
If you ever decided you wanted to work at St. Thomas, you let me know. We would probably cover a person who would just drive you around on a golf cart if you wanted to.
Now we're talking. Now, Glenn, let me ask you this about the you probably heard the legal vote, the NFL, on the PAT, moving it to the 15. When that happens, is it likely colleges will look at the same, adopting what the NFL is doing, or do you believe it'll stay the way it is?
That's a tough one, because a lot of times that the NFL adopts something, obviously, like you said, the college game does it, and there's a big difference between an NFL kicker and a kicker even at the highest level, Division III. And so there are some things that there are rules that will not be duplicated, because you can't say, well, it's all relative. At the end of the day, the person is different, but the uprights are. So it's not relative between, the Vikings kicker and the University of St. Thomas kicker. So I could see there being people that don't. I do know this. I think the college level has learned not just to follow blindly. So case in point, 4 years ago, too many touchbacks, so they ended up moving the ball back to the 30 on kickoffs, right? So they can get more excitement and more returns and all that kind of stuff. This was about 4 or 5 years ago. And so right away, the NCAA said, you know what, we're going to move it back to the 30-yard line as well. Well, geez, I mean, even at the highest levels of the NCAA, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And then a year later, they realized it wasn't rational or feasible, so they moved it back up, So they'll probably wait, see how this one pans out.
Glenn, you would have been a kid at the time, and I don't remember either, but when the NFL moved the goalposts back, had college and high schools already been back, or did they follow the NFL? I honestly don't remember.
I have no idea, to be frank. I don't ever remember a time in my life when the goalpost was at the front of the end zone. You'd have to go back to some of that old NFL Steve Sable footage to see that, but I don't ever remember. I mean, obviously, it was in, I think it was 63, 64, when Dempsey nailed that 62-yarder.
Well, it was later than that. It was like, I think it was like 69.
Was it?
It
was probably short. My guess would be it was probably shortly thereafter. I was born in 74. I don't ever remember a time where it was back there, but I'm sure it changed the game. I have seen some of, if you Google or YouTube some of the greatest hits in the NFL, there's a couple on there where guys are just blindly running into goalposts. I don't know how they did not know that would be a lawsuit waiting to happen 30 or 40 years ago.
I'll tell you what, imagine, it was 74, by the way, when they moved them. And I think Dempsey was even in the 70s. But imagine, as a coach, would you have used the goalposts and taught your receivers?
We are pretty good at utilizing whatever we can to our advantage. And, there's probably ways to do that. I haven't grown up in that, but if you're going to put me on the spot, sure, I'm sure there's ways in bowl line routes that you could kind of utilize the rub of, coming off of the back of that. But I don't know. It just seems so foreign to me.
Because you've never had to really deal with it. But it would be kind of mean, because you would think you'd have a guy breaking either inside the post or outside the post. And how do you defend that if you get a guy coming right around the post and you throw it to him?
I really don't know. But you could take the flip side of the coin. You could say, you called the perfect schematic thing to use the post, and the quarterback might throw it and it might hit the post too. I guess there's pros and cons to it both. But it does baffle me how someone didn't look at that earlier and say, we should take this 40-foot post out of the middle of the field of play.
Yeah, you're right. It lasted until the 70s. Now, the other thing I want to ask you, have you ever had issues with, for lack of a better term, with the deflate gate? What do you need in a football? I'm sure it's the same for D3, D2, all the divisions in college. What's the inflation PSI? Is it similar to the NFL, or do you know where it is?
Okay, now I know exactly what the college rule is. I have no idea what the NFL rule is.
12 and a half.
I do a decidedly poor job of not following. I will tell you, 2 hours ago, I was actually downstairs making sure that our balls for the spring game, our quarterback game balls, were being prepped properly. And so we're down in the equipment room, and it has this little, this little needle on it, and the equipment man doing it. And he's like, it's 12 and three quarters. I said, it better be 13. I said, if any time in the history of football, you better have it right on. It's now. So,
13. Okay.
So it's 13 for us now. So here's in college football, it's 13. So the deal is, if you ever did it, and you should probably do it one day just to see next time you're over, I'll show it to you. You cannot tell. If you lower that to 12 or 11 and a half, you really can't tell. Now, if you lower it down to you know, 10.5 PSI, then you can start to tell a little bit. But what people don't understand is the less deflated a ball is, also the tougher it is to actually throw a spiral. Now, yes, you might get better grip in bad weather, for sure. We understand circumference, and that's great. Got it. But it makes it that much tougher when it's deflated to actually throw a spiral. The thing that I can't understand is you look at the NFL and how they go to the ends of the earth to make sure that everything is uniform, and yet, you know, until this year, I'm sure there'll be some sort of rule next year, but one team used one ball, one team used the other ball. What I don't really understand is the argument of, well, the other team never had an opportunity to feel what that ball was like because they never used it. That's not true, because when you kick a ball, now I understand that kicking balls are separate in the NFL,
yep.
But when you're on offense and you kick off, or you're on offense and you punt, that guy who's returning that ball is returning your ball. So the other side of the other team, let alone the officials, I'm sure had to feel it. But, you know, it just seems unbelievable at how, no pun intended, blown out of proportion the whole thing has gotten.
Yeah, but it's still cheating, and that's why it's become a big deal. Now, when you, on one hand, it seems like such a trivial thing. Hey, it's a couple of PSI, but there is an established rule for it, so I guess that's why it has become the big deal that it that it is. Now, when at your level, most of the guys that come in, do you recruit a long snapper? Because superstar Mike Morris, probably one of the best, if not the best ever, in the NFL, and he made an art of it. But when you have guys coming in, do kids come in that long snap? Or do you have to teach them?
No doubt. So we'll have two types of long snappers. We have one that's specifically recruited in every class to do nothing else but long snap. And then position has gotten very specific. And so our specialist group will always have at least one long snapper, two punters, and two kickers in a group of five. And they have their own coach, because during practice, they will do all their other things. But you're right. I mean, whether it's him or whoever, there is such an art to it, to the point where, in speaking with him, when I had a chance a couple of years back, we talked about how he was so in tune to how he was snapping that he was able to actually count the numbers of rotations. Because if you think about it, you know, if you remember that old movie 20 years ago, Laces Out, what was that, Ace Ventura, yep. Pet Detector, right? Laces it's, Out. Everyone right. knows laces should be out. Well, where hundredths of a second matter on a field goal PAT block, when you want your operation to be a 1.35, and a 1.35 is big different than a 1.39, the difference in the ability for the holder to have the laces up, just like a quarterback snap would be, is a big deal. So he would be able to tell you if he over-rotated by a quarter snap or under-rotated. It's amazing at how diligent that has gotten.
You know, I ask, because I talk to a lot of college, and I'm talking D1 here, why they don't learn how to long snap if they want to play in the NFL. It's the easiest, well, not easiest, but
an average. It probably is. It's probably the simplest path to the NFL. You're right. And you know what? If you really look at high school coaches and college coaches, the one disparity in terms of what position that kid plays, they might play quarterback, they might play, but most coaches will teach their kid how to long snap. And the reason why is it's such a technical thing. It takes no hold on. I don't want to put my foot in my mouth. I'm not going to say it takes no athleticism, because the guys at the highest levels are great. You could be a great athlete, but you can be less than a great athlete and still be the world's best long snapper,
yep.
Because it's learned. It's engineered into how you do it. And now, you know, you used to see that where a lot of guys slip into the NFL 10, 12 years ago because of that. But now these guys, you know, the other thing that, you know, Glenn Caruso is 5'9", 180 pounds. I could be probably the fastest long snapper in the world. I'm not. But even if I was, I still probably wouldn't get a shot at that level, because the difference between a 5'9 kid and a 6'6 kid, when it comes to, you think about how they're built like a pyramid when they snap, right? So that length off the edge gets the edge blocker that much further away from the ball. And at these big levels, you see these guys running around, and they are tremendously athletic. I know it's tough for a school in Division I to always scholarship a long snapper. Typically, they might scholarship one in a four-year cycle, or whoever wins the job. But when you don't have to worry about scholarships, we will absolutely recruit one every year.
Yep. Well, Glenn, we appreciate it. Glenn Caruso, the St. Thomas football coach, their spring game is Saturday. Have a great time with that. And Glenn, it's always great talking to you. Thank you.
Boys, hope you feel better. Hope you sound better.
I feel great.
I feel fine.
Hey, have a great day.
All right, take it easy, Glenn. Yep. You know, I got to do that more, because
when I talk like that,
it clears me up a little bit. We're going to come right back, talk to Andy Greeter from the Pioneer Press about the Timberwolves. Timberwolves. You know, the draft lottery's on the 18th. What's that, Tuesday?
Tuesday.
We'll be talking about that in the draft. Be right back with Andy Greeter. Now, well, I'll let that finish. No, that's enough. Now Coyle gets game-winning goals. Now,
yeah.
Now that the Wild are done, he's making game-winning goals. Who's singing that? What's that from?
It's from SNL.
It's SNL?
Yeah.
I think it was a movie. We are joined by Andy Greeter from the Pioneer Press, covers the Timberwolves for the Pioneer Press and TwinCities.com. Andy, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. You don't sound any better from when I talked to you a few hours ago, Bob.
What are you talking about, Andy? This is my rig. I was thinking of going. I was thinking of going my sexy Elvis voice.
Yeah, you turned on the sultry today.
I got
here,
that.
Something.
Or now, let me. Do you know who Dave Farrell is? He's on 105 The Ticket.
Scott Farrell.
When I say Dave Farrell, he's our late guy, our late night guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. He's the one that's pretty vulgar when he was on Sirius, and
yes.
Now he has to tone it down a little bit.
Okay. And do you know the Simpson Marge's sisters? Do you know who they are? Okay,
yep.
Who do I sound more like, Pharrell or the sisters, when I do this? We're back here with Andy Greeter from the Pioneer Press. Is that more Pharrell or more the Simpson sisters?
I'm going to go more Simpson sisters.
See, that's what Hellboy here said, too.
Yeah,
maybe I have to get deeper for Pharrell. Pour me one.
Yeah, that's a little bit more Pharrell like. Yeah,
I also said about Pharrell, and he's a great guy because we've had him on, and I've been on with him a few times. I keep hearing when he talks, there's a little bit when he says, well, you can almost hear a normal voice in there. I think there's a normal voice trying to come out. Believe me, I wish mine would come out. I mean, I'm holding no pretense. It'll be gone. Usually it's a two-day thing. I'll be back 100% tomorrow. But that said, Andy, wherever they wind up, the worst they can do is fourth. How far can they go down and still get Okafor?
You know what? I think he's going to go one or two. I don't think he's going to slip
really
further than that. I mean, just based on the mock drafts that I've seen, it looks like, you know, it's Karl Anthony Towns and Okafor at 1-2. That's kind of the way that it looks, and those are the positions of need, I think, for the Timberwolves.
Well, but that's the other thing, though. It appeared after the NCAA tournament that Towns moved up, and Okafor, in a lot of people's minds, moved down. That's why I asked and I think it's ridiculous that off of the Final Four or the championship game, because he got in foul trouble, and he struggled a little bit, why he would drop at all is beyond me. I mean, was Towns that's much superior in the NCAA tournament? I don't think so.
No, I don't. I mean, I don't think so. But I think that when you look at just sheer athleticism and being able to defend the rim, which is the glaring need that the Timberwolves have, Karl Anthony Towns, I think, is the prize.
Really?
Yeah, I think that Okafor, you know, while he's better offensively, doesn't have that presence at the rim. The Wolves are the worst team defensively in the NBA, and that's where they need to improve immensely. So I think that is a key need for them.
Okay, what happens if they wind up with the third overall pick, and Towns and Okafor are gone? Where do they go?
Oh, right. Yeah. I mean, it's
Porzingis.
Well, the thing is with Porzingis is he's 19, so he's going to be a project for a couple of years. So I don't think that they want to set themselves back any further. And the other two guys that are also kind of in that spot are Emmanuel Mudiay and D'Angelo Russell. Both of those guys are point guards, and they just committed, $55 million to Ricky Rubio. So that kind of puts them in a rub there. So yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit top heavy for what the Timberwolves need, and three or four could get a little tricky for them.
Well, couldn't Russell be the two guard for them?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he's a great shooter. He's 6'5", so he's got the ability to be kind of a combo guard. But I think that one of his biggest attributes is his court vision and passing skills as well.
Well, also with Rubio, can you count on him?
Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, he played 22 games this last year, and three of his 4 years have been interrupted by injury. I mean, his ACL tear disrupted his rookie year and took an eight-out part of his sophomore season. And last year he played all 82 games, and then this year he was marred by that ankle injury that never went away. So, yeah, I mean, there's a concern if he can stay healthy, too.
But they better stay in the top two.
Because
they're in trouble.
I think you're right.
Now, I was under the impression that Okafor was the guy they've liked all year. Do you think that's changed?
Well, I don't know. I mean, they can't really talk about, you know, college players. Otherwise, they'll get hit with tampering charges like Phil Jackson did. You know, Flip is known for being an offensive guy, and Okafor's post game has been compared to Tim Duncan. So that, I mean, that could be something that they really want, and maybe that's who they go for. I just look at needs on the defensive end and how, I'm watching Tigers round the bases here in the back of, in the background as the Twins get shellacked. But, I just think that, you know, given how badly they were defensively and how there's no rim protection, Karl-Anthony Towns, I think, is maybe the better fit.
Well, let's just assume that the Knicks are getting the first overall pick. Because,
right.
I mean, if you go back to the first time they did a lottery, geez, what a coincidence. They go behind closed doors, make the pick, and who gets it? Who gets Patrick Ewing? The Knicks.
Right, right.
They're still behind closed doors. So I think the best they can go is the second pick. But boy, if they wind up fourth, there's nobody that they would take that fits the need. Their biggest need, which is that big man. That's a problem. And they're not going to go, the last thing they're going to go for is Justice Winslow. They don't need another small forward.
Right. Yeah, that's where they're probably the deepest at. You know, I think that, you know, when you have a top four pick, guaranteed, you know, if you do slip to three or four, you're going to have to just take the best player available, the guy that you have rated the highest, and go with it and just kind of keep acquiring assets. I think that's what they'll have to do. You know, if it's not the best fit, they'll just have to take what they can get, whoever they think is best there, Madej or Russell or Porzingis. I think, you know, just based on the Twitter reaction that I've seen to Porzingis, some people are just, you know, sick and tired of the losing. I mean, it's been 11 straight years, and if you draft a 19-year-old who has, you know, this incredible upside but is still so young, I think that, you know, that'll just, you know, delay the progression of this team further.
None of these guys are old. I mean, that they're looking at.
Well, right.
They're all
freshmen.
Right. They're 20.
Andy, what about if Philly is one of the teams that jumps? Just say they jump to two. Karl-Anthony Towns goes one. Do you still see them taking Jahlil Okafor, even though they've taken big men the last couple drafts with Embiid and Noel?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think, you know, it's one of those situations where you take the best available. You know, you don't want to be stuck with a guy that, you know, is not going to fulfill the potential of who they think are the top end guys. But yeah, I mean, I think that would just, you know, add to the hand of Henke over there in Philly to be able to move someone again. I think that, yeah, I mean, Joel Embiid and Nerlens Noel are guys that were taken at the top. But I mean, if that's who's best available, I think that's what you have to do. But that's a good question.
Now, is fourth, let's say the worst scenario, Willie Cauley-Stein, is it too early to take him?
I don't know. I've seen him kind of creep into the top five as well. So maybe he's an outside chance to take someone like that. Yeah, that could be someone that could be a sleeper as well.
Not really. I mean, that's not a bad consolation. If you think about it, it's pretty good. So, well, Andy, we appreciate it. Andy Greeter from the Pioneer Press, TwinCities.com. He covers the Wolves for them, and I know they have you doing extra duty now with the Wolves not necessarily playing, so it's a busy time for you.
Yeah, absolutely, and I enjoy bouncing around. Just did a Saint story, so I'm moving around.
Well, Andy, we'll call you on you again next week when we actually know what the what pick they have is. And I'm real interested by it. And by then, I probably won't have the Simpson sisters voice or my sexy Elvis voice.
So, That's right, Andy.
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Right.
Get better.
Yeah. All right, we're gonna take a quick break. When we get back, little threesome, three questions, and let me try that again. And we also have who's on first, right? Play a little bit of that.
Got a little bit of that.
Abbott and Costello, the best baseball bit ever concocted in the history of baseball bits. We will.
Three, it's a magic number.
Right.
Yeah, it is.
Yes. Actually, I'd probably sing this. Magic number.
Somewhere
in the bitch of mystery.
You
know what? Let's do the threesome, and then I'll have the, we'll do Real Simpson Sisters or Not. I'll go head-to-head with them. have the call. We actually have things to give away, including Saints tickets. Let the call in and say, who's the real Simpson sisters, me or them? All right, let's hear that first question.
Hey, Bob, it's Colin from Middle Earth. I have three questions for you. Number one, will Ricky Nolasco be able to put something together based off last night's start?
You know what's funny about that? He sounds better than I do. Oop, got one of them playing yet.
It's very similar, isn't it?
Yeah. I believe firmly that Ricky Nolasco will probably be the Cy Young Award winner this year. No, they need, I mean, what he did, they need to him, what they need is they need consistency out of all these guys. Kyle Gibson the other night, it was impressive. The seven innings he went, you know, did he have seven strikeouts?
I think it was six. I think he struck out one batter through about four innings, then all of a sudden went...
But again,
ape crazy.
What we need to see is consistency going into June and July, and you know, keep it going. That's what the key for this team is to have that not just have it. You know, early in the season, some guys have a great start and then they disappear. I'm not saying he's going to disappear, but I want to see more of that type of play and more consistency from him. I want to see a Corey Kluber like performance.
That's going to be tough for any Twins pitcher to do.
18 strikeouts in eight innings. That's unbelievable what he did last night. They also, he pretty much left his arm there hanging, too. What did he go? What did he wind up throwing? Was it 100 and... It was a lot of pitches. 100 and... Hold on a minute, I'll take a look.
Normally, you wouldn't see a guy get taken out when he's throwing that hot for the ninth inning, but...
He put
in a game and a half worth of work there.
18 strikeouts. And it's still not... I still don't think it's the team record. Like Louis T on it.
Yep, 19. He had 19. And then Bob Feller right behind him with a 16 or 17. That's not bad company.
No, it's not bad company at all. That's incredible, though, what he did. All right, what's the next question?
Number two. The conference finals are set for the Stanley Cup playoffs. Who do you got in each series?
Chicago.
And both of them?
Chicago, no, Rangers. And you know what's amazing about it? Did you see the numbers on Lundqvist?
His Game 7 record?
Exact same day, 3 years in a row. 35 saves in 2013, 35 in 2014, 35 last night wins. Game 7 wins. The same day, 3 years in a row, 35 saves, 3 years in a row. That is staggeringly impressive.
He is a big-time clutch goalie. It's going to be interesting in that next round in the East. Ben Bishop just had a really good series against Montreal. I think New York's got a much better offense than Montreal does. So he's going to be seeing a lot more shots come his way.
He is, but there's something about the Rangers. I'd love to see Rangers-Chicago as a Stanley Cup would be fun.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk to, remember the Chief, David Alcaro?
I remember that guy.
We're going to be talking to the Chief a little bit later. He's been following and going to those Ranger games. We'll talk about that in the Preakness and the NBA playoffs, but what a performance. Yeah, okay, those are the two I like. I know Anaheim is very good, but that Chicago team.
I think maybe Corey Crawford doesn't carry over what he did to the Wild into this next series. He could have a really tough time.
Maybe so.
Facing that fast, big Anaheim team.
Yes, but those the offensive players, the core surrounding him, is pretty damn good, as we know.
Yeah, that should be a really interesting series. I don't think Tampa's going to put up too big of a fight against New York, but you know, I've been proved wrong before, so hopefully they can make it competitive.
Yeah,
I'd like to see both teams go relatively, or both series go relatively deep, so you're getting teams that have had about the same amount of action heading into the Stanley Cup playoffs.
I'm looking forward to it. Let's just leave it at that. Okay, what's next?
And finally, Mike Zimmer says the safety spot will be fine after competition this year. Is the future starter on the roster right now?
Well, I'm thinking that maybe it could be Anton Exum. We talked about that yesterday with Jim Suhan. I think Exum has an opportunity to be the starter.
Yeah, they seem to like him. They also really like the undrafted guy, Anthony Harris, that the Vikings signed after the draft this year.
Yeah, but
kind of a project thing, but...
Yes.
Seems to be a lot of safeties on this roster going to be vying for that spot next to Harrison
Smith. The other thing is a 36-year-old cornerback, Terrence Newman, I think he could wind up being your safety, too. You get to be that age, you move him back. That's what it happened. Ronnie Lott moved back. You know, some of the great cornerbacks in the history of the game wound up moving back to safety as they got older. Certainly not putting Newman in one of the greatest of all time, but, I mean, it happens. So I don't think, I think that's a possibility that a cornerback could wind up going back.
And Rod Woodson, I believe Ty Law.
Woodson did too.
These are guys that jump back.
And both, I think the Woodson and in the case of Law, maybe Law, I'm not sure, all pros at both positions. But Woodson, yeah, and
Woodson definitely was.
Yeah, Woodson, but he, so was Ronnie Lott. Those are the two best examples. And I don't know anybody else who gave up a finger to play, you know. Take it off.
I got a game, doctor.
Take the damn thing off.
That is your real name.
Yeah. Get rid of that. Just get that puppy off and let's move on. Do we have time for the Simpson off?
Yeah.
Sounds obscene. All right, let's hear from the Marge Simpson sisters and see if you can tell if it's me or them.
Sing along.
Go ahead.
We love to smoke.
We love to smoke.
Lungs to gray. Love to smoke.
We love to smoke.
17 packs a day.
How many?
I don't know. She said 17. 17?
17.
That's a lot to get that weird voice.
We love to smoke. Like a Jim Chimney. Although
that's good.
We're broke. Before 2003.
I gotta be honest.
I think I sound more like him than they do.
I can't tell the difference.
Actually, mine sounds more like Marge than theirs. That's pretty good. I love the two Simpson sisters. We're going to take a quick break. You know what? When we get back, we're going to play, as advertised, a little bit of Abbott and Costello. And we're going to be joined by George Mumford. He's an author of the new book, The Mindful Athlete: Secrets to Pure Performance. Here's a guy who's worked with Michael Jordan and LeBron James and a host of others about getting inside the minds of great athletes. George Mumford, our guest when we return. Joined by George Mumford, author of a new book, The Mindful Athlete: Secrets to Pure Performance. George, I hope you don't mind Shout.
No, I love that song.
Well, good, because our producer's always picking out songs, and sometimes he really pisses people off with his choices, but I'm glad we got one right this time. You've worked with Michael Jordan, you've worked with LeBron James, you've worked with a number of top athletes. What's the thread that goes through all of these guys?
I've not worked with LeBron James.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you had.
Yeah, no, he's not one of the ones I've worked with. But the threat is the commitment to excellence, their ability to seize the moment or be in the moment and to be themselves.
Well, and that's when you've dealt with, like I said, at the highest level, I've covered a number of these athletes. There's certain things that they have also about. There's an arrogance that they have to have, that ability to have faith in themselves, that no matter what, a lot of them just feel like they're invincible. Is that a big part of what you've seen, too, the guys that they think nothing can stop them or hold them back?
Yes, well, I'm not so sure I would call it arrogance. I'd say it would be supreme confidence, and it may appear to be arrogance to others, but the difference between arrogance and having supreme confidence, arrogance is just a cover for fear, whereas the folks you're talking about, they know that they can control, they can't really control what happens to them, but they know they can control themselves, they can control their response to it, and that they put in the work necessary for them to succeed.
Now, for you, George, you went to UMass, correct?
That's correct.
And you had a roommate that a lot of people would know. He's known as the doctor, Dr. J. Is this what got you on this path to be, you know, to deal with elite athletes after having a roommate, you know, Julius Irving, Dr. J, and seeing just, you know, how he was? You thought maybe you could, did you learn from him and apply some of that?
I definitely learned from him, but back then I had the illusion that I could be one of the guys that played basketball in the NBA or I don't know if I really thought beyond that, but as things would turn out, my weaknesses led me to a place where I started to study the human mind and body, and as a result, it put me in a great position to pursue the MBA, but not as a player, but as a sports psychologist.
Okay. You've also worked with you worked with soccer teams. You worked with Sasha Cohen, and you know. It's interesting when you're talking about figure skating, which is what Sasha Cohen obviously was, a silver medalist in the Olympics. Is it different when you're talking to people who are, it's not like with a basketball player, they score, they help their team win. These athletes like Sasha Cohen are dependent on people scoring them and judges. That's got to be tough for a lot of athletes. No matter how good they perform, it may not matter if the judges happen to like someone else. And as you know, politically, there's a lot of politics, particularly with figure skating. Do you have to talk to them about that, too? If you feel you had a good performance, don't worry about the outcome?
Yes, that is, I think you hit the nail on the head. Even whether it's an individual or a team, a person is just playing, you know, like Sasha Cohen, she's just competing against herself. Even people like Michael Jordan, it's basically the same. They're competing against their previous best self, and they can't really worry about what other people think or do. They have to focus on what they can do and do the best they can do and let the cards fall where they may. So anytime you compete or perform, even if you were to do something, if you try too hard or you worry too much, the results are probably not what you want. So there has to be an ability to let go and just perform and let the cards fall where they may, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely it does. See, and the thing that Cohen goes through, my family shows horses, and many of the times you show, it's judges. I hate judges. I mean,
yeah. They're
not, because you could have, and you know it's a superior performance and a great performance, but they may like somebody else for whatever reason. No matter how good you and your you performed, or in the case of a horse show, they did it. And it's just and sometimes you think it's political, and sometimes you wonder what the heck happened. That's why I asked the question about Cohen, because I'm sure that she felt she may have had the best performance when she won the silver medal, but a judge liked somebody better. Maybe it was fair, maybe it wasn't. That would be a tough one for me at that level, for all you put into it.
Yeah, well, that's the interesting thing. What I would say is, if we could have judges that were more mindful and more aware of their personal biases,
yep,
so that they were able just to value who was doing, based on the performance, not on who is doing the performance. There's an interesting thing. I'm trying to remember. It was one of Malcolm Gladwell's book, and I don't know if it was, maybe it was Blink, and he talked about how when people would try out for orchestra, they had them perform behind a shield or behind a curtain so that they wouldn't know who the performer was, and just evaluate the person's ability just by
what they heard,
listening to them. And to me, this is what you're pointing at, that people have these unconscious biases that are obvious to outsiders, but maybe not so obvious to themselves. And maybe sometimes they are conscious of their biases, but if we could get to the point where people are just, like you said, just evaluating based on the performance, not on who's performing, or not even allowing your likes and dislikes to color how you're perceiving things, it would be very interesting. And I think you would find that there'd be less of that. But then again, you also have to think about the person who is perceiving, because I know when I am my home team or a team that I'm working with, so I like, I have to watch my own biases because I'm looking at something based on what I want to have happen. So I think we all have it to some degree, but to the degree that judges, like you say, or officials,
yep,
or umpires, if they could be more mindful and more leaning towards who had the best performance, forget about who did it or who the team was, I think it would be a very interesting turn of events.
Now, we're talking to George Mumford, author of the new book, The Mindful Athlete, Secrets of to Pure Performance. And, George, I got to apologize. I don't normally sound like this. Maybe you could help coach me into my getting back to my old voice. But I know you're involved with the Knicks and Phil Jackson. Have the Knicks had you psychologically?